The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
The best of you from Kmart Radio. KMRT.
C. Derek Varn is a reader at Zero Books, a poet, blogger, and podcaster. His podcasts have included Symptomatic Redness and Former People, and he is a frequent guest on Zero Squared. This week we discuss Gilles Dauve and his essay, When Insurrections Die. We discuss the relevancy of Dauve's ideas in the Trump era. Here's an excerpt from that essay. The essence of anti-fascism consists in resisting fascism by defending democracy. One no longer struggles against capitalism itself, but seeks to pressure capitalism into renouncing the totalitarian option. Thus reduced to anti-fascist resistance, social critique is enlisted in dithyrambs to everything it once denounced, and gives up nothing less than that shop-worn affair, revolution. It's Wednesday, March 15th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Thanks goes out to members of the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to the Inside Zero Books podcast, which sometimes consists of unedited or full-length interviews from the Zero Squared podcast, sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from Zero Books authors. This week, the Inside Zero Books podcast will feature the second half of this very conversation with C. Derek Varn. And in just a moment, you'll be listening to our discussion of When Insurrections Die. So we're going to talk about Gilles Dauve's essay, When Insurrections Die, from Endnotes 1. So this was written a while back.
Yeah, I mean, it's written way before Endnotes. I mean, this is a translation of an essay that I believe was published in the 70s. So.
It's interesting how relevant it seems still.
Well, it actually seems more relevant now than when it was written. And weirdly, the people who published it have taken the opposite stance in the light of Trump. So while Joshua Clover, for example, is not a member of Endnotes Collective, he is closely associated with them, and he is one of the theorists cited the most by BAM and the groups around the anti-fascist movement in Berkeley.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So you get really weird in that, you know, one of the primary thinkers around that, and even his book, Riot Strike Riot, cites some of Dauve's worker, Dauve's worker, however you pronounce the name, it takes a different stance towards anti-fascism, when anti-fascism in the form of spontaneous riot, which I don't think Trapoline, which is Dauve's collective, would actually take. And it's also kind of important to know where Jean Dauve, who also wrote under the name Jean Borot, I believe.
So it's Gilles, Dauve or Gilles Dauve, and then Jean Borot,
Jean Borot, which is what he wrote under when he was writing around the Situationists, because he was attached to them in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
But he also came out of the – he had some knowledge and relationship to the Bordigas currents in France and Italy.
Well, he's interesting to me. It's interesting to me that he's attached to the Situationists because – or was associated with them because his understanding of value theory – I can't say that it's deeper than their actual understanding, but his writings around Marxism and actual capitalist production seems to me to fit more with actual Marxism than Guy Debord's writing around the spectacle did.
Well, I would agree with you. I think the spectacle is under-theorized, and I think DeVay, whatever you might make of his theories of communization, really does believe in value theory and the abnegation of value as the ultimate form of communism. So, and that collectivization, as he talks about at the end of this essay, was part of the problem that led to a lot of the delusions around anti-fascism, because collectivization did not seek to destroy value. It didn't seek to change society in that primal way. It was actually driven by value itself. And as anyone who's ever worked for a government corporation or what government entity will tell you, they have no problem exploiting their workers either. It's not like – in fact, it's easier for them to justify in a lot of ways. So sometimes exploitation by government, by nationalized government sources, is actually worse. So that's something he brings in at the end, but that's not actually the main thrust of this essay that we're talking about, which is when insurrections die. The End Notes volume that is published in volume one is actually like from a debate between DeVay and then an opposed communization group, a different group of thinkers called Theory Communiste. And they go with it in a different way about will subsumption. But the fundamental question that DeVay is interested in after the Situationist, and you see this in another book of his, the decline and reemergence of the communist movement, where he's always trying to figure out the same question that, say, many like Maoists after 1980 are trying to figure out, like, why did the working class have no interest in actually abnegating itself? Some of his theories are somewhat vague, but unlike the Maoist, it doesn't require like a conspiracy theory of capital to work. All Maoists don't believe that, obviously, but you know, third worldists do basically believe that there's collusion between the state and business to pay first world workers more than their value. And I don't know how that works. The only thing I've ever gotten that ever made that make sense was talking about logistic trains, but that doesn't explain differences in productivity and all those other things that really, you know, it really just doesn't make sense as anything beyond, you know, the relationship of first and third worlds largely primitive, more based on primitive accumulation, not primitive accumulation that somehow was given to first world workers so they'll never rebel. I mean, like, that is effectively a conspiracy theory. DeVay doesn't go that way. I mean, he doesn't seem to – if he actually – in this article, he makes a lot of, like – he doesn't mention it outright, but he makes a lot of pop shots at Maoists and stuff. Like, one of my favorite ones is, the revolution, the power does not necessarily come from the barrel of a gun any more than it comes from the ballot box, which is like a direct at Maoists. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. So what this is about, this piece, When the Insurrections Die, is taking a look, at least at the very beginning, and I think it kind of holds all the way through. It's taking a look at how this old kind of Walter Benjamin cliche of behind every fascism is a failed revolution can be seen historically and kind of is proven out.
Right. Right, but you're completely right, but it has a secondary point, one that should make us a little bit uncomfortable given all of our politics lately, is that both united frontism and pure anti-fascism do not and will not work to fix it.
Right. Yeah, that is those are first of all, I don't know how opposed those things are. I don't think they are opposed. Antifa politics and pure United Front politics, I don't think are fundamentally opposed.
I would say that the anarcho antifa would say they are, but I would say objectively prove it, because you don't riot as much or at all during a Democrat's election year, and don't cite Occupy as an example, because you weren't part of that, or you were, but you weren't like the instigators. It's not the same thing as like shutting down Milo or punching Richard Spencer or something. And this is talking about this on a much larger, more effective scale. I mean, you're talking about like actually equipped armies and spontaneous uprisings that involve guns. I mean, like, you're not talking about
there's something like that going on right now against ISIS.
Right. Right. So it would be like talking about the Rojava and the YPG and all that stuff in what is effectively quasi Kurdistan and Syria and northern Iraq. And Duvet would be speaking directly to that, because what it would be saying is like this coalition government that they have with these other parties, including Stalinist ones and left in all kinds of different leftists and Republicans and Kurdish nationalists. Like, this won't stop. Want to abolish capital. Like, quit fooling yourselves. And this also probably won't even defeat all the reactionary elements themselves. And that's kind of true, because what are the choices that the Kurds are going to have is how much they're willing to make peace with Assad. Right, and how much they've already had to make peace with the United States. So, depending on how you feel about the U.S., and I don't think we're fascist in any pure sense. Yeah, but it just proves right there, like there's a problem there. And I like to bring up a historical comparison that isn't mentioned by Duvet, because I don't think he really writes much about East Asia, but South Korea. And the liberation from the Japanese went the same way. So what happened to the anarchist resistance to the Japanese is it split. Part of it became the core part of the Juse regime, and part of it was actually cheerleading American bombings of the northern part of South and the lower part of North Korea. And it also introduced racial ideas in from Japan and Germany that did not exist, that is part of both regimes, like both South Koreans and North Koreans use it. But literally the word was coined by one of the early members of the anarchist movement, who wrote a mythical history about the Korean people that is still sort of super influential. And talks about the Minsul, which is a something that doesn't even like the word for blood race doesn't even exist in Korea until that point. And so it's happened before. These anti whatever authoritarian movements that are purely in that and coalitional can't, as Duvet says, it's not just that they delay revolution, it's that they don't work. Like, they don't actually get rid of fascism either. Fascism usually is done in by its own excess or by an outside state.
I want to go slowly through, especially the beginning part of this essay where it's talking about the Russian Revolution and how that connects, how the attempt to take that revolution to Europe connected to or has had some influence on the rise of fascism. I want to go through that with you, because I know you're going to be able to make sense of all this better than I can.
So a lot of things that Dadaab does in that first book, I mean, first couple of sections, I say book, it's actually, it's just a very long essay, yeah. Is he talks about the compromises around Brest-Litovsk, which is we're going to expand a revolution, but in buying time and making a deal with a social democratic government. This needs to be remembered. They were not making a deal with a fascist government. Making or even a conservative government. They are making a deal with a social democratic government to delay any war over partitioning Poland. And so they were saying they were the way it was phrased at the early time is they were delaying the acquisition of space and land for time to build up the Revolutionary Army. Now, the thing is, he brinches this in the very beginning, but then doesn't really pick it up till he doesn't really pick that back up until the end of the essay. So almost like this question of how the Soviets relate to this, and why he considers the Soviet Revolution failed by 1921, mm-hmm. Which is probably one of the earliest dates of considered failure, is really fascinating and kind of important. Because he's not coming out and saying that, like, he's got critiques of Lenin. He's not a Leninist. But Bordiga, who he's pulling from, is a Leninist. Mm-hmm. A very particular kind of Leninist, though. It's not the same as even the other ones within the Italian Communist Party. So where that leaves you is he's sort of like – setting the moment of failure, not at vanguardism, which he doesn't even care about. Like, that's not a question for – like, it's not the issue. The issue is the way the party became immediately sucked into its own survival in ways that recapitulated capitalist order. Mm-hmm. Moment of the Civil War forward.
Right.
So once you get into the Civil War, they never recover from that. And the other thing he talks about is the idea that the germ of socialism, and this is interesting because it sounds like Bernstein, but it's something even the teleological assumptions of the Leninists made, is that the core of socialism was already available in bourgeois democracy, that there's a kernel. So the reason why you preserve bourgeois democracy was that there's a kernel of the need for socialism there.
Right.
And not in the we need these productive forces means, like, there's some kind of teleological idea there.
Now, let's stop there for a minute. What kind of... Are we talking about just the kind of bourgeois freedoms that you find in the market that would be the germ of an idea of a real socialist freedom?
It's unclear. I think what he says is the claim was made is that the idea of democracy enabled by bourgeois capitalist development would necessitate some defense, because even if fascism was a particular form of capitalism, as both the Trotskyists and the Bordigas believed, they believed it in different ways, though, and he kind of gets into that. The issue becomes like the idea that what you're doing is saving a teleology of capital that necessarily goes into communism as an endpoint. It's, you know, that whole mm-hmm. science of logic versus phenomenology influence on. Communist theorist debates. Like, if you think about our discussions about what was the book in particular that we were discussing?
Oh, it's the one about Western Marxism that we were.
Yeah, the one about the Western Marxism and left communism and the relationship between the two.
Right.
And that would they talk about, you know, how some theorists favored the phenomenology and some theorists favored the science of logic.
Right.
Although that's not a clean – you can't actually cleanly say that, like, Stalinists favored this and Eurocons favored that. That's not actually how it worked. But one of the things that the people who tended to favor the science of logic for Hegel did, and to put more emphasis on that, is to see communism as an axiomatic teleological necessity that would happen no matter what. I mean, you even see that in the way that, like, Khrushchev talked about communism,
mm-hmm.
like his beating the stuff on the UN. That's related to that.
Right.
And what
when he beat his shoe and said, "We will bury you."
Right. I mean, they really believed that. And it was like, it was a necessity. It wasn't like, we are just better than you. It was like, history will go this way.
Right.
Like, the contradiction's not, this is the only way the contradictions can unfold. And one of the things that Duvet is saying is, oh, there's all kinds of ways the contradictions can unfold. Authoritarianism is perfectly compatible with certain modes of capitalism, but it's probably temporary, and democracy is compatible too.
And that's, but it's also probably temporary. And that's
right. It's exactly.
Yeah.
Depending on the integration of the workforce into the nation and the integration of nations with each other. So the interesting thing about Duvet actually lays down, for someone who's not like a scholar of fascism, like period, probably lays down the best theory of fascism because he knows the history really well. I mean, he was born at the end of that time period. He was born in 1947. So he's got this down. And what he points out is, like, A, they were relationships to the early, you know, proletarian movements, and particularly in Italy, mm-hmm. that some of them even called themselves fasci.
Right.
And, you know, the history of Mussolini is well known on this topic.
Yeah.
But B, like, the bigger interesting thing there is that the first thing the fascists did that really made them separate is when the de-peasantized agrarian proletariat tried to rise up, right?
Mm-hmm.
They disarmed them. The fascists disarmed them.
Yeah.
Before they were the fascists proper. And their relationship was still unclear. And then what happened basically was, in these street fights that developed, there was a coalition government in which the members that were related to the fascists were brought into this National Front government. And actually, for a whole lot of Mussolini's reign, it's very different from Hitler's trajectory. Mm-hmm. They actually did rule in a coalition with liberals,
right,
who played both sides of that conflict off of each other. It was only actually when the Republic of Salo was found, when Mussolini wasn't leading a coalition government. So, and that was thanks to Hitler. I mean, it wasn't even of his own accord. So the point there was, all the anti-fascist and all the United Front stuff that was going on, none of it actually worked.
Right.
Partly because they were compromised from the onset. And the communists became tied into that, particularly once Berdiger lost his party chair.
Mm-hmm.
And Gramsci tried to, quote-unquote, Bolshevitize the Italian Communist Party. And when that happened, they had to adopt the line of the Comintern, as dictated from Russia, to adopt united and popular front strategies. The point there is, like, none of that did anything to stop the onset of fascism. At all.
Right.
And what increasingly happened is, in the instability of all these shifting coalitions, the executive got stronger and stronger and stronger until the legislative couldn't control it anymore.
So the problem is that it was swept up by the state. This united front was united with the liberal factions in the state, which were collaborating with Mussolini.
Right. But I mean, all of them are collaborating with capital too. I mean, one of the things he doesn't talk about, but if you know the history of fascism, like, there were a lot of really disgruntled anti-capitalist fascists too.
Right.
So it was sort of like, this is seen as a necessary placeholder till we can completely and totally take power, which for Mussolini, the complete and total takeover of power only happened thanks to Hitler, and actually only after most of the, you know, they'd lost control of most of Italy. So it's a very strange sort of deal there. I mean, like I said, that's only in the Republic of Salo where you really see Italian fascism completely dominate without coalitional politics.
Right.
But the only thing he points out, and this is absent in our own time, is that all these things do start out from street battles. Right. And street battles that come out of a frustrated and shut down attempt at a revolution, where the divisions between the left, and between what became the communist and what would become the socialist really set things up for failure immediately. And this is a much bigger deal in Germany.
So you wouldn't count Occupy as our, you know, muted attempt at a revolution?
if it's a muted attempt at revolution, it's revolutionist farce.
Right. Right.
I mean, the thing is, for us in the United States, our mass movements are mass compared to movements 100 years ago, but compared to the size of the population, they're all tiny. I mean, even Occupy.
Yeah.
It's just our standards have been set so low by, you know, I mean, even when you look at the 70s, which was the heyday of the particularly the anti-revisionist left. I mean, they were bombing people. They tried to, like, there was a Puerto Rican communist group that tried to assassinate a president, and we totally forgot it even happened. Like, I was just reading a book about this recently and how buried all this was. Even then, you were talking tiny movements, and they were way larger than anything we've ever had since then.
Even bigger than the Women's March?
No, but the Women's March is not
a movement.
The Women's March is not a movement. It's an event.
Right.
And it's an event with what goals, with what demands, with what program, with what even attempt at communization. It's not even what Occupy was, which was to try to like prefigure it out. It's right. Just we don't like you.
Yeah.
And we have some demands, you know, about reproductive rights.
Right.
But then there's other things going on, and we just need numbers. And what do we do the day after this march is over? And what you were immediately, you know, told is join the resistance, go vote. That's not what resistance is.
Right.
And one of the points of Duvet is if you've gotten to that point, you have already lost.
As we speak, we are finding the drug dealers, the robbers, thieves, gang members, killers, and criminals preying on our citizens. One by one, you're reading about it, right? They're being thrown out of our country. They're being thrown into prisons, and we will not let back in.
I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible.
We're all so
Jew, Gentile,
night and day,
black man, white.
To keep
we all want to help one another. Human beings are like that.
Terrorism.
We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers,
Don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, or what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. World that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
The law and the Constitution give the president the power to suspend immigration when he deems, or she, fortunately it will not be Hillary she.
Let's go back though to the history, because what he says is, in making that deal, what happens is the Social Democrats sort of flounder for a bunch of years, and they have anti-Semitic members in their own ranks. They were talking about, you know, German Jews were fine, but these Polish and Ukrainian Jews are totally infiltrating our society. He doesn't mention, but he hints at the fact that a lot of the right wing of the Social Democrats, and here I'm not talking about Bernsteinists. Bernsteinists often get accused of this, but the Bernsteinists were actually on the same side of the vote against World War I as the Bolsheviks were. But anyway, so they sort of just abnegated their point here and started focusing on small level local politics. The sort of center right of the Social Democrats, with here from forward, started, you know, to try to get rid of these revolutions that weren't going, were kind of devolving. You know, they empowered the Freikorps. They gave them names. They gave them some of their early members, and some of the key of the Gestapo and the Nazi regime were actually Social Democrats in 1918. Now, they were also probably like 17. They were young, and they went right-wing pretty fast. But in this thing of national defense, maintaining the German state, they did that. And, you know, that's where all the, you know, memes on Facebook about, you know, Bernie Sanders murdering Rosa Luxemburg come from. But I mean, like, there's a historical truth to that, because the SPD was who gave the Freikorps the locations of where they were, and some of their generals came from the SPD. So like the Freikorps. And so what do you do with that? Like, that's the Freikorps is the historical genesis of a lot of the groups that would coalesce around Nazism. So. You know, and the end of the Bismarckian Republic's related to that, but it's all there from moment one, and it's tied into, you know, Lenin after the Civil War. They didn't feel like they could possibly, for historical necessity reasons, possibly go and take Germany or even take Poland, right? And then they talk about how the whole treaty that enabled that kind of goes up in the flames anyway, and the Nazis and the Soviets scramble for it in the 30s anyhow.
You know what would be really helpful? I mean, maybe it's impossible, but a counterfactual story might be worthwhile, you know? What could have happened that would have held off fascism at least, or maybe made the Russian Revolution and the revolution in Europe succeed, or at least fail better than it did?
Arguably, the key moment is when Kalski sat on his hands during the... Because he didn't vote for the war. That's actually sort of a myth. He just abstained from the vote, letting the right wing side actually win. And that's when the Bolsheviks split off. That's when the Spartacists split off. That's when everything starts to fall apart in Germany. Now, it probably would have fallen apart anyway, because I mean, it's hard to imagine some of these social democrats being able to exist in the same party as the Bolsheviks, because are even Mensheviks, frankly. So it's those social democratic parties would have very hard time with it. But that's probably one of the key moments. Another key moment is the Brezhnevich treaty, of which Russia could have gone to try to liberate and protect the Soviets established in Germany and Hungary, the various workers' republics and worker council groups that developed in 1917, 1918 after the disintegration of the German state, but before the establishment of the Weimar Republic. But that didn't happen either. And it's very different because fascism, one of the things that it's implied by this is fascism is not the same thing as Bonapartism. Arguably Trump is weird in that if you take classical Marxist typologies, he kind of sort of fits the mode of Bonapartism, but he doesn't. He kind of sort of fits the Burgess Trotskyist mode of becoming fascist, although not fascist yet, but not quite, because the street movements aren't there. He's too integrated into a bourgeois party, et cetera, and so forth. So, but it's easy to see like how things get out of control. So for example, one of the things that I think liberals do not think about at all is, let's say they succeed in impeaching and removing Trump on some things like the Emoluments Clause. Well, one, not only is that going to empower a religious right that did not get elected, all right, that, you know, because Trump's like, please come along with me with Pence, will become de facto rulership, and in some ways it would be more conservative than Trump's regime. But the other thing would happen is that a whole lot of the electorate that is already depoliticized would be both further depoliticized and angry. The idea of that, the idea of like election nullification, unless you could prove for sure that, you know, the Russians and Trump knowingly colluded to overthrow the U.S. Constitution, like I think that would go really south real fast, and you would actually maybe see a fascist movement develop. A real one, not just the alt-right, like we listen to Depeche Mode and are racist and it's liberalism for white people only, but like something far more scary, where like a lot, like the militia movement being more truly folded in, and more and more mainstream Republicans declaring a party and like backing those things, and maybe even some people funding that. You know, in a very real sense, it's not really super funded right now, and that would be bad. And even if the left wing went more militant,
which is unlikely, by the way, I think that's an unlikely outcome of a Trump impeachment, for the left wing to become more militant.
I mean, me too. I think they were more likely to.
I actually think they're more likely to be demobilized,
but they might become more if they became more militant in the like arming themselves way that you hear a lot of it, except for the people, the like 450 some odd anarchists who fought in Rojava, like, and maybe 100 Marxists in the entire country who are in the military. They would have a hard time. And I know they always like to make fun of alt-rightist as like, oh, they're, you know, yeah, the Richard Spencer group. Yes, they're kind of nerds. But those militia people are not. And, it's, you know, particularly like the 3%ers, they are absolutely not. And while, yeah, I mean, they're kind of geeky and nerdy and in some ways down on their luck and a little bit pathetic, but they really do have combat skills and they really are in good shape and they drill. I mean, like, and you start looking at mass movements of that from defranchisement, you'd have a major problem. So with Trump, you're kind of, you know, part of the point of Duvet is, like, when you get in these moments, like, you can really screw yourself in what looks like an anti-fascist movement. Like, really bad. And if you don't think about what you're fighting and how you're fighting it and what could result, You're almost guaranteeing that you're going to have serious problems. And that essay, I mean, the most of that essay is a very long essay. It's going through exactly what happened with some of these groups in Spain, in Italy, and in Germany, and how like, a lot of the counterfactuals, it's like, if we'd only done this, this wouldn't have happened. He just proves, like, he gives a history, like, no, that's just not true. It would have happened likely anyway. Like, there's very little you could have done once these certain things had happened, and he does put that on the Bolsheviks, basically, after 1921, that could have changed the results. You know, that you're dealing with other, like, retrograde parts of capitalism, and he's like, and, you know, reformism, he also mentions that reformism and revolution are not just about whether or not you're violent.
That's an important point. That's what we have, right? I mean, that the Antifa movement is not a revolutionary movement. And it's not just that the Antifa movement isn't a revolutionary movement because I say so or I'm critiquing them and saying that. They often themselves will say that. That they're about resistance. There are anarchists, at least there are anarchist tendencies in the Antifa movement, which are all about individual liberty, lifestyleism, and perpetual resistance.
Right, and sometimes the perpetual resistance is going to just empower a different bourgeois group.
Right, well, they don't care what the impact is of that. It's all about protecting their own.
Right. Now, that's not true for all of them. I mean, right. The thing is, Antifa right now has about three different major theorists, some of which, like I said earlier, are tied to communization, who believe, and I might be mischaracterizing, I'm reading two books on this right now.
I'm
one
characterizing
written by one of
the Pacific Northwest green anarchists, you know.
Who are involved in Antifa, and they're involved in Antifa in Berkeley. Then you have the liberal anti-racists who are involved in Antifa, but, you know, still accidentally beat up a Muslim kid. Our dude, I don't. And then you have the communization theorists around Joshua Clover, who are Antifa because they believe in the CMC disrupted capacity of riots, which I don't really want to go into. It's a whole different problem, but that's one of their theories. And they also take one of these theories from communization about real subsumption. And say that we have moved from – actually, it's the same thing as the under-consumptionists say in a way. It's not the same thing, but it's very similar, where they say we've moved from a crisis of production to a crisis of circulation. And that riots disrupt circulation more than strikes do. And I'm like, well, so far from what I can see, I don't see where any of these riots have disrupted circulation at all. So, like – like, I don't see how you can justify that. I mean, I can see where you can say that
people can't go to Starbucks the next day.
You shut down a college campus. I mean, it's funny. I mean, you want to talk about, like, the contemporary things, because I actually saw a couple people on the internet from BAM say the same thing that Bill Maher did. This gets to your point about how they're not really revolutionary.
Right.
That, you know, we caused infighting to bring up dirt from Milo's past, which is the same thing Bill Maher said. You know, like, sunlight's right. The best infectant. I caused all this, you know, all this scrutiny. And I'm like, this is not what that is. This is a certain strain of members of the right who are like, you know what, we're not going to let this go any further than it's going to go.
Right. If Milo hadn't gone to that, what was it, the CPAC? If he hadn't been invited to that, he would still be a superstar.
Right, and Breitbart would still have him on. I mean, like, right.
He would still
it has nothing. Right. He was about to launch another return to Berkeley, so, I mean, he wasn't even afraid of that.
No.
So it's just funny they see these people try to claim that. I'm like, you know what took him out? A teenage girl took him out. The right took him out when they found out about it. And it was a coalition of the religious right with neoconservatives.
Yeah, the anti-Trumpers, the never-Trumpers, basically.
Right. The mixture of the Mormons, because the Blaze is, you know, strongly tied to Glenn Beck.
Right.
And religious conservatives around that. And then the anti-Trumpers around McCain, who have been, you know, I've seen even lauded as heroes by Democrats lately. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is objectively insane. And this is exactly the kind of thing that Duvet is talking about.
Right.
You know, and so if you want to be a Marxist or a rebel for the status quo, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't make any sense. Don't call yourself don't call yourself a Marxist. Yeah, and do that. But, you know.
The thing is, even you and I were talking about, like, what would a united front look like? Well, I don't have any idea because I can't even get the I can't even imagine the DSA, which is probably the largest socialist organization, to formally announce a program that would allow it to cut ties with most of the Democrats. I'm not even saying all of the Democrats, right. Just most of them.
Right.
So like, and that's to me the most promising socialist organization in the country.
Right.
And it's that sad. I mean, like,
right.
there are movements within that group now that are pushing for something similar, for actually stating that, you know, we are at least actually socialists, not just progressives or whatever. And while market socialism may be a debate, we're not Keynesians. But it's still a sub-movement. It just happens to be very well medially represented by their representation on Chapo Trap House, on Current Affairs writing staff on The Baffler. But that's actually not the majority of the movement.
Right, no, but they have some great PR right now. They've got some good people working for them.
They do, and they have good people, and they have funny ideas. They haven't been, you know, actually not even bad ideas a lot of the time. It's just still so vague.
Yeah.
But I do like, you know, I do like them basically calling for the proverbial heads of the DNC to be brought to by them on a platter, even though it's not going to probably happen.
No, I don't think so.
But it is. So, like, if that's our best hope, where are we at? And what's weirder to me is it's weirder to me that, like, quasi-social Democrats of all people are taking stronger stances, you know, even after Trump, against the center Democrats than some of the far leftist parties are. And the far leftist parties that are not range from anti-vanguardist groups, I'm not going to point names, to the CPUSA and other groups that are explicitly Stalinist, and they're on the same side.
Yeah, what do you think explains that? What do you think? Because, I mean, first of all, leaving aside like the people I had on the Shouting at Marxist podcast and the CPSU or Communist Party USA, I mean, and the people you just mentioned, what other Marxist groups are out there, and are they really doing the same thing?
There's SALT, which is the second largest socialist organization. Now, I think it's even bigger than the ISO. Mm-hmm. And so far I can tell, they put one one quasi, you know, one socialist on a city council.
Right.
And but then
they're aligned with, I think they're aligned more with the DSA.
They are, but they're Trotskyists. So like there's issues there.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, if you
but yes, they are vaguely aligned with the DSA.
I think that the left Marxists kind of split between, let's just try to hold off Trump and support whatever the forces are, whether it's Glenn Beck, Hillary Clinton, some teenage girl, you know, right, tweeting, whatever the forces are.
Let's support Jamal Bury and Slate, like, and Sean King's new career at the New York. The New York right. The New York Daily News.
So the force is basically just, let's stop Trump no matter what, aligning with whoever and whatever we need to in order to do that. That's one side. And the other side is, let's attack the center of the Democratic Party and align with...
Yeah, and also attack Trump too, but
and attack Trump too, but the real focus is, I think, on the Democratic Party and trying to gain control of the Democratic Party.
Right. You're using your attacks on Trump basically to show why it isn't important to dethrone the center of the Democratic Party.
Right.
And a lot of those people seem agnostic on whether or not they can do it within the Democratic Party or outside of it.
Right.
And where I'm just like, you can't work with Democrats for anything other than tactical gains ever. Like you just can't do it. But, you know, and I've actually softened on my stance on this stuff, and it's funny. But it's, yeah, go ahead.
The people who are more, I think, politically radical in their theory are more likely to just say, let's just, whatever it takes, throw Mormons at Trump, I don't care. And the people who are more aligned with social... you know, democratic socialism or social democratic principles are more likely to be attacking the Democratic Party right now. That's what it seems like to me.
To me, that proves that there's a major crisis in Marxism in the United States and worldwide.
No, I agree.
This is it, man. This is what your grandchildren are going to be smoking. The future.